we would actually talk about the idea that what we do underwater is very closely, very similar to what NASA was planning to do in space with the space station. You know, you've got divers and remotely operated vehicles assembling, constructing, maintaining complex structures underwater. NASA at the time was just in the planning stages of assembling an international space station with astronauts in suits and robots, and then maintaining it over a long period of time.
Welcome to the Manufacture Houston podcast, where Houston's manufacturers come to share, learn, and grow. Brought to you by Alchemy Industrial. For more information, check out alchemyindustrial.com. In today's episode of the Manufacture Houston podcast, we talk to Mark Gittleman with Aegis Aerospace. Mark takes us through an amazing journey of his, from being a deep sea diver with an oil and gas company to now the CEO of an aerospace company. We also talk about the history and the future of aerospace-related manufacturing right here in Houston. Well, Mark, welcome to the podcast. So glad to see you on this cold Houston morning. How are you?
Oh, couldn't be better. Thank you. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. You know, I'm really excited about this podcast because we're going to talk about space stuff and what person doesn't love space and the cool stuff that's happening in the space industry. So I think our listeners are going to get a lot out about this conversation. But before we jump into all the cool stuff that your company is building, I'd love to learn more about you and your background and how you got to where you are now, and then we'll jump into what you're doing now. So tell us about a bit about yourself.
Okay. Well, I feel like I've had a very unusual career, and I feel really blessed by it, actually, because it's been so much fun and so interesting. But educationally, I have degrees in both political science and engineering, separated by a number of years. So when I was in college the first time, I decided I wanted to go be a deep sea diver, a hard hat construction diver. And it's kind of a funny story. Those trade schools are very expensive. So my parents and I cut a deal where if I would finish college, any degree, they'd pay for the trade school. And I'm sure they thought I would not do that. But that's exactly what happened. So I got my poli sci degree, which I've always found that whole topic fascinating, but it's hard to make a living that way. Mm-hmm. Went to a commercial diving trade school, learned how to be an underwater construction, hard hat construction diver, packed everything I owned into my Datsun, drove to Louisiana, and started an apprenticeship as a commercial diver. And fast forward, you know, you do your apprenticeship, you learn the trade, you become a diver. And what I did was underwater construction. It's hard hat surface supplied diving. So you've got, you know, the hose to the umbilical to the surface. And it's hard, dangerous, very exciting work. And it's, you know, it's for a young man. And I once in a while a young woman, but it's once you get past about 30, you need to start thinking about doing something else. And even before I got there, soon after I got married, my wife and I decided I really needed to start thinking about doing something else. So I went and got an engineering degree, and I assumed I would go right back offshore. This was all Gulf of Mexico. And you know, it's an exciting life working offshore and doing that kind of work. And it's very productive. You know, it's not as cool as space, but everyone needs energy. And, you know, back when I was doing this, that was the source for everyone's energy. So I went and got my engineering degree, and I ended up in the end right back at the same company that I had been diving for.
And what company was that?
It was Oceaneering International. Right. So at the time, one of the largest underwater services companies in the world, but the oil field at the time took a hard crash. And we had a visionary CEO who saw all the talent that we had and was the kind of person who would, as he used to put it, make bets on people. So if he had some smart, motivated folks with an idea, he'd let them run. And so one of those folks was a guy named Mike Gernhardt, who Mike and I, when we were very young, Mike was also a Diamond. And when we were young, working in Morgan City, Louisiana, we would actually talk about the idea that what we do underwater is very closely, very similar to what NASA was planning to do in space with the space station. You know, you've got divers and remotely operated vehicles assembling, constructing, maintaining complex structures underwater. NASA at the time was just in the planning stages of assembling an international space station with astronauts in suits and robots, and then maintaining it over a long period of time. And so we were talking about that. And then I left the industry, got my engineering degree, called Mike for something totally unrelated. And he said, "Hey, I'm starting that space business we used to talk about. Do you want to come back?" So I did. And I was the first engineer in Oceaneering's internal startup, Oceaneering Space Systems, here in Houston. Wow. And we just went around and told that story. You know, what assembling, constructing with humans and robots in space is substantially similar to what we do underwater, and we're very good at the tooling, the operations, the thought process that goes into it, the systems engineering that goes into it. Planning for a deep water construction project is not very different from planning for a space construction project. And we did it. So we, you know, people believed us, and, you know, they believed us because it's true. Mm-hmm. And we started this little division of Oceaneering and grew it. Mike went on to become an astronaut and had four successful shuttle flights. Eventually, I started as an engineer, but project manager, program manager, et cetera. I ended up running that division for quite a long time. At one point, we were probably the largest manufacturer of spaceflight equipment in Houston, down here in Clear Lake. So, and that, you know, one of the interesting things for your Houston listeners is probably the fact that correlation between deep water and space, it's really true. It applies to designs. It applies to life support systems, turned out to be a big deal. A lot of what we knew about deep diving, what we call saturation diving, which is where you live in a pressurized complex for an extended period of time at pressure, the environmental control and life support systems that you use for that deep diving are schematically almost identical to the life support, environmental control and life support systems for a spacecraft. And if you can understand one, you almost certainly can understand the other. There's always differences, but they're in the details. And that same thing goes for designing tools and equipment for the astronauts to use or for the space robots. Yes, the material selection is different, and a lot of the details, you know, you have to learn the difference between high pressure and no pressure, impacts of vacuum on materials.
Still a pressure differential, right?
There is still a pressure differential.
Right.
You know, seawater is nasty. A vacuum is especially nasty for many materials. But the fundamental idea is sound. And so I've carried that with me the whole time. One of the things that I've always believed and still do is mixing the industries the way we did brings benefits to both. Mm-hmm. So I have, you know, to this day, I am happy to look at candidates from outside the space industry as engineers, project manager. I mean, really, you name it, because it's like adding a seasoning to a recipe. You know, it's sometimes a little exotic seasoning can really add something, right? And we saw the reverse too when the shuttle program ended. And there were a lot of excellent people down in Clear Lake who were not quite sure what to do next. And this was, call it, this was in the 2008, 9, 10 2011-12 period, the oil field was booming. And we came down, we recruited heavily at Clear Lake. I left the space industry in 2010 for 4 years to go back into the subsea industry and run our deep water controls business. And we came down to Clear Lake and just scooped up as many as we could find. And, you know, many of them had no idea what the subsea industry was all about, but they were good engineers, they were good project managers, they were good analysts, they were good machinists, whatever it was, and they did great. We brought them into the oil field, they learned the language and the acronyms and, you know, the subtle differences, and they did great. And so my career and background, then in 2014, I left the oil field probably for good, and went back into the space business. And I've been here ever since, first with Intuitive Machines for a few years, which is a neat company, one of the commercial space companies here in Houston, that's really doing great stuff. And then the company owner, Stephanie Murphy, of a startup commercial space company, reached out to me and asked me if I wanted to come, if I wanted to talk to her about running her startup called Alpha Space. And she did something really, really cool. And we'll come back, I think, to the whole space, commercial space thing that's going on right now. But Alpha Space, she founded Alpha Space to commercialize in space testing services. And I definitely want to come back to that because it relates closely to manufacturing and technology development. So she had the idea that she could put a cooperative agreement together with NASA to take a concept that NASA had been using for quite a while. They called it MISSI. And we kept that name, by the way. But MISSI was Materials International Space Station Experiment. And NASA had flown several missions with different MISSI designs to test materials in space. Back to that vacuum is really nasty part. Stephanie said, look, let me put a commercial system together and provide that to as a service, both to you, NASA, and to the whole world, to everybody. And they said yes. So she put this deal together. She spent 3 years developing a brand new, highly capable MISSI system, plus standing up the business and developing customers and all that stuff. And then she reached out to me to take over the company as the CEO because she had to do something else. And that something else is go back into the company that her father had founded almost 30 years before called MEI Technologies, which is a large engineering services company specializing in mostly in space and defense engineering services. Her dad, the founder, was retiring and she bought him out and became the majority owner of MEI Technologies. So now she had two companies. And one almost 30-year-old high-end engineering services company and another scrappy startup commercial space company. And we ran them that way for a few years. And then early last year, she decided to combine them into one and rename it Aegis Aerospace. And she asked me to run the combined companies. And so that was last summer. And now here we are.
Well, holy smokes, Mark. So that's a long journey from being a diver in Morgan City, Louisiana, to what you're doing now. What an incredible story. And you mentioned something that was really, I kind of chuckled as you were talking about it. This phrase you use, exotic seasoning. I can't think of any more of an exotic seasoning than a diver. I think that's on the extreme end of seasoning. So I love this story. What this reminds me of is sort of the story of Houston and what happens in Houston and in manufacturing. It's not like a straight line, is it? It's this you know, you kind of go from one good thing to another and try to make a difference. And you certainly did. So thank you for sharing that. That's an amazing story. I can't wait for our listeners to hear it. So let's talk about Aegis, and let's talk about something that's near and dear to both of us, which is manufacturing, and in your case, manufacturing related to the space industry. So catch us up with sort of the state of manufacturing as it relates to the space industry. Where have we come from, and where are we now in your view?
That's such a good question. You know, the tradition is take a big block and make it a small block, right? You carve away everything that's not your precise little part or big part. And we've both seen those massive milling machines that make even spacecraft structure, like the ISS, the International Space Station. Those are carved aluminum hulls. They're just amazing. And part of the reason for that, and part of the reason it's hard to get past that, is that in the space industry, we like to know, you know, right down to the raw batch material, everything about every part. So, you know, I joke, it goes back to the mine. That's only a slight exaggeration, right? But you do know in the traditional way, everything about every part. And that's expensive. You know, it does reduce your risk about as far as you can get it, but it's expensive.
When you say market, when you say everything about every part and the mine, are you saying going back to the original source of that material?
I am. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, material traceability. So, especially a high criticality part. But one of the things that we used to make a lot of is the astronaut equipment for spacewalks. And a lot of those, NASA would call a lot of that equipment criticality one. And crit one parts are parts that if they fail, it can be a part or an assembly. If it fails, you risk loss of vehicle or life. Okay. And so for crit one part, we have material traceability that, you know, we know exactly what it's composed of. We probably do chemistry tests to validate it. We have all the records of all the heat treats. We've got, you know, of course, the machining and the dimensional inspections. We've got the, sometimes we'll have coupons to do strength testing with. You know, it's really, really, really detailed understanding. And then you do all the finite element analysis. You might do dynamic analysis. You look for all the high stress areas. You get rid of them. It's the most detailed engineering you can imagine. And that's accompanied by, in the traditional way, the most detailed manufacturing you can come up with. You know, and sometimes we're measuring tens of thousands of an inch.
So that's a very complex supply chain manufacturing activity that's related to what happens in space.
It is. And so, you know, we have traditionally had in the Clear Lake area around the Johnson Space Center, a very small handful of machine shops that can do that kind of work. Mm-hmm. Huntsville, Alabama also has a small supply chain out in that area. So the areas around the space centers, Los Angeles has some, the traditional center of American aerospace. But it's a challenge for the companies that do the manufacture that way to also do other things, because you build a lot of costs in. Mm-hmm. You've got that level of precision and understanding. And so Houston's manufacturing has been mostly oil field. And that's a lot less precise and, you know, lower levels of quality control. That's one of the things we talked about that last time, is the idea of oil field machine shops or manufacturers in general doing aerospace manufacturing. And it can be done. It can be done because it's the differences are on the margins, right? It's a little more here and a little more there, but you're already doing the basics. So it takes will, you know, cost some money. And that's all still, the reason I laid out that background is because I think where we're going is much more additive manufacturing. Mm-hmm. And we've been talking about it in the industry for a long, long time. There's a lot of it going on already, but the difficulty is in the structural parts, mm-hmm. the high criticality parts, because as you know, it's more difficult to get to that level of precise understanding with the composites, you know, whether they're layups or if they're printed, any kind of printed material, you know, where are the voids in the composite is always a question, right? Mm-hmm. How do you know it's not going to fail? We can be pretty sure, but usually that's not good enough.
Well, certainly, if you think about the quality requirements for traditional manufacturing and all the methodologies and the instrumentation and tools that can assess quality for that versus where additive is, there's still a pretty good gap between the two.
That's it. I think the gap is narrowing. Mm-hmm. I mentioned Intuitive Machines earlier. They are printing in titanium and Inconel in the area around Ellington, the Houston Spaceport. Rocket, very small rocket nozzles. So there's not, you know, those aren't high stress parts, but they've got an additive manufacturing and design for additive manufacturing process in place. And those nozzles they're going to fly to the moon. Mm-hmm. So we're getting there, you know, we're getting there. It just takes, we've been machining traditionally for decades and decades, right? And it's going to take a while for the additive part to catch up, but I think we have to. You can get the cost down, and you can do very interesting design work.
If you know
how to take advantage of that, right?
Do you think how well do you think Houston is known for being a center of space-related manufacturing? Objectively, as it stands today, how would you rate us?
Very low.
Yeah.
And it pains me to say that, but it's true. It's true, and I have a hard time understanding why. I've thought about it because we do have a pretty decent manufacturing heritage in Houston. There are a lot of oil field manufacturing companies, you know, a lot of big fab shops, machine shops. There's a lot of oil field manufacturing and almost no space manufacturing or aerospace.
So Mark, I'm going to give you a magic wand. And maybe if I give you a real magic wand, you wouldn't use it on solving space manufacturing in Houston, but let's just say you have to. So if you had to sort of help to solve that problem of creating a base of space related manufacturing capabilities in Houston over the next 2 to 3 years, what kinds of things do you think that we should be doing? And what should that magic wand that now is in your hand produce in order for us to begin claiming legitimately this idea that we are a center for space manufacturing?
Fun question. I think for added manufacturing to really be accepted in the space industry, we need to figure out a way to understand the product as well as, or close to as well as we understand the machined part. We may not have to be right down to, you know, the atomic structure. But we need to be, it needs to be highly predictable, and we need to know it for a fact. Mm-hmm. So it may be a different method of analysis. It may be different methods of test. Because I think we're at the stage now where everybody wants it, but we're such a conservative industry. Even today with all the entrepreneurial space activities going on everywhere and the things that, you know, SpaceX is doing and Blue Origin is doing and companies like IM and even Aegis are doing. I think what's holding it back is that really, really nth level engineering understanding of the product. Because if we had that, I think you and other additive manufacturing companies, you can make the parts, mm-hmm. right? I think what's holding it back is that lack of, is that caution, you know, that lack of just complete understanding.
So less about producing the geometry, which I'm sure we can find ways to produce the necessary geometry. And I love this phrase you use, know it for a fact, because you talked earlier about this idea of criticality one or crit one components, like being able to say that we know for a fact that this component meets that crit one requirement. Bridging that gap of understanding seems to be very critical based on what you're saying.
I think so. And there's a lot I don't know about it. You know, Boeing's making parts for airplanes and has been for a while that are composite. So it may be part educational too. Maybe it's just helping everybody understand, no, we do understand this and we can prove to you that it's okay. And here's how, and just, maybe it's just a socializing thing. You know, it could, or maybe it's some of both.
I think it probably is some of both. So let's talk about sort of if you look at the engineers that are working in the space industry today, and let's be specific on additive manufacturing. How would you describe sort of the level of understanding around design for manufacturability when it comes to additive and those kinds of concepts? Because you and I talked about that a little bit a couple of weeks ago.
You know, it's even our entry level engineers, you know, the ones that you might hope would, you know, bring that with them from school. They don't. They don't. I think, you know, I would expect people that have been designing parts for 30 years, you know, they know how to design parts, right? You carve metal away. But I had hoped that our youngest engineers would come in with, you know, some fresh ideas about designing for additive manufacturing. And I'm actually kind of surprised, but they're not. So I think we're maybe we have to go all the way back to universities and make sure that our young engineers and designers are thinking about this from the start, and then just, you know, start with the fresh ideas, because you always count on your youngsters to bring the fresh ideas, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
We're just not seeing it. At least we're not.
Yeah. Yeah. Old timers like you and I are somewhat fixed in our ways to a certain extent. But you're right. I think the certainly the hope is that your new engineers and new talent can really help shape that. So then that brings up an interesting point, at least from my perspective, or a question. If you're talking to someone who's considering the space industry, among all the other things that engineer could do, what is the pitch for that young talent or that new talent, engineering or otherwise, to come into the space industry and help Aegis and other companies sort of create the new frontier of machines in space? What's the pitch to them, Mark?
Man, for me, this is the easiest pitch in the world. I wish I was 20 years earlier so I could do it all, younger, I mean, so I could do it all again. It's the coolest stuff you can do. You know, the first time you see something you design on the news up in space, you never forget that. And so you get to do really cool stuff with really great people. And yeah, you can go to Silicon Valley and design an app and, you know, and get really rich, maybe. And that probably won't happen in the space business, but you'll certainly make a good living. But you'll be doing the most interesting things a person can do with some of the best people you'll ever meet. And that's the pitch.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. I think that was a great pitch. I'd be excited to do that, because I think you're at the frontier of innovation and invention. So Mark, let's just wrap up with continuing to go back in time. So I'm going to take you back in time, put you in a time machine. So you're that younger Mark as a diver, and you're you know, working every day in Morgan City, Louisiana. What would you tell that guy today if you could somehow meet him? What would you tell him about the adventure that is to come, and what kind of advice do you think you would give him?
I probably tell them the same thing I tell everyone. It's all going to work out. You know, it's, we all have, and engineers especially, have a lot of choices in this world, right? If you're an engineer today, you can do almost anything you want. And I could have gone back into the oil field. I even did for a little while. But I love the space industry. I love putting stuff in space. I love the people I know. We're designing a couple of systems to go to the moon. One of them's almost done. And I was showing it to some people yesterday who've been in this business a long time. And I said, that thing right there sitting on the table, that's going to be on the surface of the moon in about 2 years. But, you know, go ahead and touch it if you want to. And, you know, and they both did, because the idea that you could, you know, that thing you're looking at on the table is going to be on the moon in a couple of years. It's, where do you get that? You know? So I would tell that young Mark, you know, follow your nose. It's going to work out. And, you know, do a good job. Think ahead. Work hard. It's all going to be good.
I love that advice. I think that's really great advice for any person at any stage in their career, but especially for young people, because quite often I think young people have this notion that they should plan out their career, which almost never works out as they intended, but it's all going to work out. It's a great piece of advice. So Mark, how do people listening learn more about Aegis, and how do they get in touch with you?
Aegis Aero, AEGISAERO.com is our website. We're on social media as well. And I am mark.gittleman at AegisAero.com.
Great. Well, Mark, thank you so much for your time. I feel like I could talk to you for hours, and I'm sure we'll have more conversations. Maybe some of them recorded, maybe some of them not, but what a wonderful journey that you've been on. And I know that journey continues with you and with Aegis. And we're so excited to see that thing on the moon in a couple of years' time. Can't wait to see that happen. And we're really excited for you and what you guys are doing.
Well, this has been really fun. It's gone by fast.
Thank
you for inviting me. This was neat.
You got it. All right. Great. Great deal. Thank you, Mark.
This has been the Manufacture Houston podcast, brought to you by Alchemy Industrial. For more information, check out alchemyindustrial.com. If you'd like to be on the show or want to recommend someone to get on the show, just reach out to me on LinkedIn. MUSHKHAN, Mushkan. I look forward to hearing from you.